So today's chapter, again, to recount, would be from 1 Samuel chapters 8 to 12, dealing with the transition to monarchy from federated states. So I will not be covering chapters 1 to 7, which deal with starting with Hannah, like Samuel's mother, the last judge of Israel, his birth, his training, and his kind of coming of age as a prophet. So what's happening here? So what is the historical context? So it is sort of, in secular understanding, it is understood that around 1200 BC, there was a major influx of people. They call them sea peoples because they don't know where they came from, but apparently sort of from the Mediterranean, from the the Aegean direction, which led to a collapse in that region among the pre-existing powers. Collapse doesn't mean like extinction, but like a collapse in their actual power. So Egypt, the Hittites, and the others around, they were heavily disrupted by the arrival of these sea peoples, as they call it. This is 1200 BC, which was during the Judges period, or just before that. And that's why when you look at Judges, you're looking at a historical context where there's a lot of, in a way, chaos. I mean, it's not really chaos, but there's a upturn in the sort of the political surroundings. So a lot of the traditional, like the Egypt and Hittites would always fight over the Canaanite lands. Now they have retreated to their own lands because they need to deal with the arrival of the sea peoples. So this is the context of the book of Judges. So you have Israel, who do not have firm boundaries, living as small kind of enclaves or city-states, very loosely kind of connected to each other, with all the people, or a lot of the people that are meant to clear from that land, like the Amalekites and the others, they're still around. The Philistines are still around, so it's not a very clear-cut land of Israel, where you have boundaries that stretch nicely around their central land. So this is what is happening. So now 200 years have passed. Now Samuel is kind of, I think, around 1150 BC or something like that, or 1100 around, or yeah, so around that. I mean, not everybody can get to agree what exact time period this is, but around that, around 1100 BC, plus minus 50 years. So now the major powers, they are starting to reestablish themselves. New advances are coming along. And the predominant power now in the immediate surrounding of Israel are the Philistines, the what do you call it, the city-states, like the five city-states of the Philistines. And then you have the Ammonites, the Amorites, the Edomites, the Moabites, Amalekites. They're all there, from going clockwise from sort of northeast all the way to the south, to the Amalekites. The Philistines are to the west of Israel. So what is happening now is Israel is living through its consequences for not having heard God's word and clearing the land when they were told to do it. So, you know, long-term consequences over hundreds of years, and some you might argue even now. So Samuel is the last judge, and the interesting thing, and there are new sort of horizons, so new challenges on the horizons, like political, geopolitical challenges. The nearest one we'll read now is from the Ammonites. Ammonites are basically the descendants of Lot, so Abraham's nephew. So they're kind of related, but, well, so are the Moabites and the Edomites. So what happens typically geopolitically now, I promise I'll stop talking about history and geopolitics, but I find this fascinating because it shapes how we understand the world and how we respond to it. It is our opportunity to actually apply God's principles. So in this case, what happens whenever there is a major churn in the political landscape, some powers collapse or some kind of new powers come along. So then you have people with new aspirations, new kings who want to conquer, things like that. So this is what Israel is seeing. The tribes of Israel, they are seeing this like, okay, now new people are wanting to become the dominant power in that region. So this affects their sense of security, right? So this, understand that is the basic sentiment there. I used to think that the reason that they transitioned into monarchy was that they were tired of the chaos, or what one would call chaos. That, you know, you have these tribes, the 12 tribes, that are loosely associated, but they kind of manage their own issues. Then they have judges who kind of make sure that there's a central kind of, at least in law, there is a centrality, but otherwise in administration, they're quite federated. But I, having read this, I think it is less to do with chaos, because I think, because there were a lot of judges under whom there were many decades of peace. I think one of the longest was Ehud or something, like 40 years. Even Samuel, if you read chapter 7, it gives you a sense that there's a long period of peace, meaning that doesn't mean like no war, no death, not that, but like security. More than peace, it's like long periods of security. So I think it's less to do with a sense of insecurity and more to do with the Jews or the people of Israel were tired of being the underdogs. They were heavily overwhelmed by the military, economic, and social power of the surrounding regions. And I think this really kind of enticed them. It was very attractive to them. And they were tired of that. And they saw their loose-knit society as a problem towards achieving that kind of a glory, let's say. This is my understanding, so don't take it as biblical truth, but this is my understanding of what was their intention. So just to cap, so this is just a setup, and to cap the setup, I'll read from chapters 7, 3 to 4. And Samuel said to all the house of Israel, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." So the people of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. So chapter 7 ends with, you know, each judge essentially addresses one period of, let's say, backsliding among the tribes of Israel. So this was also the same thing. So chapter 6 was all about how, 5 and 6 are all about how the Philistines, who are superior in militarily to the Israelites, they come and capture the ark. They take it back, but they bring it back because, of course, it's God's ark. So the Philistines go through certain troubles of their own. And Samuel confronts the tribes with their own sin of having assimilated into the surrounding cultures. And they basically repent. And that starts the era of Samuel's judgeship, where there is peace. And if you turn to chapter 7, verse 15, it says, "Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went on a circuit." So basically he was going through different parts of the landmass, and he judged Israel in all these places. And he built, and to the end of the verse, and he built there an altar to the God. To the Lord. And just in end of chapter 14, it says there was peace also between Israel and the Amorites, so they had captured a lot of the land back from the Philistines. So there was relative security under Samuel. And now to the main part, the transition phase, and it starts with the first few verses in chapter 8. So if I read 1 to 5, "When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." And immediately the verse starts with a problem. Not that Samuel is old, but the problem is that his handing over to the next era of judges. So he makes his own sons judges, and these sons are no good. They are they do not follow in their own father's footsteps, and they are basically corrupt. They may not be abominably corrupt, but they are corrupt. They corrupt the ways of justice, and you can see the effect that this has on the people. If you put the context that already the people are feeling insecure about what's happening around them, and then you see that this judge, Samuel, who's given them perhaps decades of security, he's getting old and he's passing the mantle to his sons who are no good. And they, most importantly, they do not enjoy the confidence of the people themselves. They know that these people are corrupt, and perhaps they also know that they're incompetent. You know, corrupt people can be competent, but perhaps they were not confident that these people would actually be able to provide the same level of security in terms of being conduits of God and being able to judge righteously. And that's why they go to Samuel and say to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways." That's a scathing indictment of Samuel. I wonder how that must have felt to have heard that. And the interesting part here is that if you read chapters 1 or 2, Eli, the chief priest who actually under whom Samuel trained, was accused of the same thing. His sons were worthless fellows who perverted justice and did a lot worse than apparently what Samuel's sons did. And there's a whole, I mean, there are multiple verses, maybe even half a chapter dedicated to how corrupt Eli's sons were. And there's major portion, like at least like a big paragraph dedicated to mentioning how God rejects Eli's household. So Eli being the chief priest, so then his household is no longer, it's cut off from the priesthood. That's a very harsh, and to the point where, you know, basically his house would be cut off. It's not just losing your title, it's losing your lineage. So that's a very harsh judgment on Eli. Samuel should have known this, and yet he oversaw his own sons following to some part in Eli's son's paths. And the trouble starts from there. One could argue that perhaps the people of Israel were already feeling the same thing. I mean, they were already thinking very pragmatically, like in like how to achieve things in this world kind of a thing. But I would lay a lot of blame on Samuel's decision to pass on the judgeship to his sons when his sons were apparently no good. And yet, a small thing also I found that, okay, Samuel's sons were no good, Eli's sons were no good. But if you look at the punishment that Eli and his lineage suffers, is magnitudes in order, like, more harsh than Samuel's sons. So perhaps it has something to do with Samuel's sons perverted, sort of, you know, they were corrupt. But Eli's sons were, like, because they were priests, so their corruption was even of a greater degree, because what they were doing was their corruption was happening inside the temple, not the temple, but, you know, in and around the God's ark and things like that. So they were insulting God in that sense, and here they were being corrupt. I don't know, maybe this is reading too much into it, but Samuel doesn't suffer the same fate as Eli. And so, yeah, so that's one thing to take note of. Yeah, so before I go... Yeah, so, and then, yeah, so if you continue from chapter 8, verses 6 to 9, so what happens once they ask? So it ends, verse 5 ends with, "Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." The operative phrase over there being, "like all the nations." Then, so now how does Samuel react? Verse 6 onwards, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them.'" So, I know there's a, at least I've heard sermons that like, you know, well, Jesus was always going to be the king. That was preordained plan. They would, through the David's lineage. So the fact that they're asking for a king in itself is not the sin over here, but the fact that they are asking it with the wrong intention. And yes, I think I would also fall on the same side of it, but I would say, I would be a little harsher. I would say that we don't know what God's plan was. Maybe after a century, this is his plan. But the point is, the request came from the people and not from God. And I think that in itself is a major sin on the part of the Israelites. And it is very clear over here how God takes it. He takes it as a rejection of his leadership. So there's no arguing with it. I'm sure like Samuel as a human perhaps felt that, you know, the people were rejecting him as a judge. To some extent, maybe that was true. But I think God reassures him by saying that, you know, what your rejection is nothing compared to what they're doing to God himself, which is they are rejecting him in spite of all that God has done for the people of Israel, right from the days of Egypt, the Exodus, to even now, as it says. And I think this is something we can all relate to. Our lives are full of examples of God's working, his miraculous or his providential or just standard plans. The fact that we are sitting over here is his plan. And yet, when it comes to testing times, at the very least, we falter in our thoughts. And at worst, we do things that reject God as our, you know, as our leader. In our life, in our own life, in our own family's life. And, of course, you can then extend it to your nation and all that, but at least taking it personally, in our own lives and in our family's lives, this is how it starts, you know. And one would think, like, in all this, as I was reading it, when you look at all the episodes of rejection that Israel puts God through during their, you know, voyage in the desert and the Korah's rebellion and all that, the punishment is swift and very stark. Like, you know, people die, there's a plague and things like that. But here, I mean, in God's own words, It is an outright rejection of him, and yet God actually participates in fulfilling the people's desire, which is finding them a king. I haven't been able to find, like, you know, why or something, like, okay, I mean, you just have to take it, but I just thought that was an interesting contrast that even though they do reject him, perhaps there is not a sense of sinful rejection. I don't know. This is my inexperience, so I can't convey that. Maybe that's for you all to study later. Like, why is this rejection any different from the previous rejections? For technically, they do not suffer anything except for a small thing that we'll read through later. So there's a quality to this rejection also, perhaps. And also, sometimes God punishes you immediately, sometimes he'll punish you down the line, a few decades, few hundred years down the line. And that's how it ends there in verse 9. Obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. And apart from a few, I mean, David, you could say, was a good king to them. But even Solomon was a very exacting king, as in like high taxes and things like that. And the United Monarchy actually fell because of the high taxes, because Solomon's son did not want to let go of the taxes. So, yeah, multi-generational problems. And if you read, if you read chapter 8, verse 5, and 19 to 20, so just looking at like the reason the people state why they're asking for a king, at least two times, is very clear. Chapter 5 ends with, appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. And then in verse 19 and 20, it goes, but the people, so Samuel gives them a warning against the kings that will be coming and what they'll do to you. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. So it's not just, so the people do not contemplate what Samuel says, that are like, yeah, but let us still have it. It's more an outright rejection of Samuel's warning when they say, no, there will be a king over us. We want one, we will have one. And the reason they say is, so that we may be like all the nations. So that itself is a major red flag that we should be worried about in our own lives as well. Like when we look at prosperity or anything that we like in our own eyes around us, and we want to be like them at the cost of God's leadership. And they say that all the nations, like, so that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us. Well, they already had a judge. They've had many judges. So this was nothing new. But they wanted a king who would judge like all the kings of the land surrounding them, with like supreme authority and things like that. And this I found interesting. And go out before us and fight our battles. The interesting thing is, in many of the battles that God fights for the people of Israel against the Philistines, it is actually literally God fighting them. You know, it's not and there are instances where God, you know, empowers the people of Israel, you know, gives them strength and courage and tactics, like wisdom, to actually defeat their enemies. But there are many times where God goes ahead of the people of Israel and sows confusion among the camps. So much so that they are actually fighting each other. You know, so that is literally God fighting for them. So they had this, they knew this, and they still wanted a king who would do the fighting for them. So one can think, then, why would you ask for a human to fight for you when you have God doing the same fighting for you? And, well, we all fall to that sin, and I think it's a perhaps a little, they wanted heroes, somebody they can see and somebody they can, you know, sing praises to, as they did for David also. That started a series of problems when they start, you know, like Saul kills 1,000, David kills in his 10,000s or whatever. I think there's a tendency among everybody to have this kind of hero worship. You have these statues of generals and statues of this and that, like you attribute this general led us to victory. And it may be true at a pragmatic level, like yes, he was the general who, when the victory was gained, but this is how the slippery slope of, you know, idol worship starts. And again, I'll take you back to the context around them. There were kings, Nahash of the Ammonites, he was starting to gain some territories, starting to become a conquering hero. The Hittites, the Egyptians were always looked at as conquering nations. And they always had this king. You know, it could be Shalmaneser or some Assyrian king or some Egyptian pharaoh. So I think Israel wanted somebody as a totem. Like, you know, like this person is our hero. And surrounded by nations with conquering kings and with terrifying reputations, so they wanted something like that. So I sense that the reason that they actually wanted a king to go out and fight for them was because they wanted the reputation. They wanted that honor and glory of a terrifying reputation in the land for this king, which they can then associate with. It's very easily understandable if you look at the sports that people follow these days. I mean, why do sports people, like, you know, it could be athletics or it could be football or whatever, why do they make so much money? I'm not saying they're not worth it. It is purely because it's market forces. And market forces is that people literally worship them. I mean, well, not literally, but effectively, they worship them. What do people gain by cheering for somebody at a football match to the point where they'll get into fights with the opposite team? It is a point of, you know, you identify yourself with a hero, and therefore you are a hero. You know, I mean, I'm sure psychologists have studied this kind of phenomenon where, you know, you partake of somebody's heroism by identifying as them being your heroes. I think, again, so there's nothing new under the sun. So this was possibly what the people of Israel were also had in their minds. They wanted a hero that they could see, touch, and shout at or sing for. So, yes, so Samuel, 1 Samuel 8, it starts with a demand. It starts with a problem identified, which is that the next generation of judges did not enjoy the confidence of the people. The people were perhaps already in a mind to behave like the nations around them. God sort of calms down Samuel and tells him to give them a warning that all of it which came true, which is that their sons and daughters would be taken away as for labor that is not of their own choosing, either to be as soldiers or to be working in the vineyards and olive orchards and to be basically servants. And the taxes would be high, which very soon did become very high. And so, I had a small thing over here. Sorry. So, and then it ends with the people of Israel reaffirming their request, and God basically saying that, so be it. You've asked for it, so be it. And I just want to add a small thing. So, one thing is, like, the choice may not have been catastrophic. They didn't ask for a golden idol or anything like that. They still left the choice to Samuel, God's anointed, to choose them a king. So, in a way, they were still giving God the choice. You know, we want a king, this is our want, but you choose. So the choice was not catastrophic, in a sinful way. But I think the consequences, they ought to be thought of. And this is something we can apply in our own lives very easily, that not every choice that we are faced with is a clear distinction between a condemnable sin and a glorifying, option. There are many options that you could do. Like, for example, where do I work? Do I move to the city? Do I move to a different country? Do I buy a new car? Things like that. You know, they're not sinful by themselves. But the thing is, when warned, and the Bible is full of such warnings, you know, your actions and your choices will have consequences. When warned, one needs to be doubly sure that you have done all that you can to your conscience's satisfaction. And to make sure that your conscience is sharp and informed by God's word. And I think that's what is happening here. The people of Israel basically did not heed the warning. And this became a multi-generational problem. It became a problem for centuries, and maybe you can even say millennia. The United Monarchy failed after three kings, and that basically sowed the seeds of conflict between the tribes and then to the eventual dispersion and things like that. Right. So now we'll move on to chapter 9 quickly. 9 and 10, I'm going to skip that because this is about Saul, and I'm not doing a character study on Saul just yet, or if ever. But very quickly, Saul was chosen by God through Samuel. It wasn't the people's outright choice, but it was certainly a choice that appealed to people. He was handsome, he was tall, he was, as they say, head and, like, from the shoulders, he was taller than everybody. So maybe he had a very long neck. I don't know. So, what does that mean? Like, from the shoulders, he was taller than. I guess it just means that, you know, in a sea of people, you could very clearly see his face. He was just, you know, certainly taller than everybody else around him. It all goes into, like, you know, how Saul finds himself at the point where he actually visits Samuel. Samuel is already told by God that, you know, at this appointed time, I will send you the person who will be the next king. And one thing to notice, like, okay, just short things about Saul. The name itself actually means asked, and they add, like, asked of God. That's kind of implicit. But asked of God. It's interesting that God actually gave them a king whose name was what exactly they did, which is they asked of God for a king. As it's almost as if it's like a, not irony, what's it called? I forgot the word. Anyway, it's like poking them. It's like, well, you asked for him. So, you know, in that thing. Yeah, so one thing about Paul is that when you look at his the entire story from chapter 9 to 10, it comes across as a very positive, like, or he comes across as a very mild and circumspect, you know, a person who is self-aware and not overly egoistical, like almost humble, actually. So if you read verse 21, chapter 9, when Samuel says that, you know, is it not for you and for all your father's house? And, you know, is that, like, you are the desirable one, you are in God's mind? And then Saul answers, am I not a Benjaminite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then have you spoken to me in this way? So here, everybody knows Samuel by now. He's the established prophet. And when Samuel gives him this positive indication of his being chosen, Saul is taken aback. It's like, you know, my family is the least prominent of all. How come? That's his basic question. Okay, one could argue that's a genuine doubt. But then when you look at the other signs, you could look at more positive traits. So when after that meal, at the end of chapter 9, beginning of chapter 10, Saul says that, you know, these would be the signs. Go on, you've been anointed, these would be the signs to confirm your anointment. Saul is, he's quiet. He doesn't laugh, he doesn't say, ah, come on, it can't be. He's quiet, he considers it, he actually takes the signs, you know, of like his father's servants coming and asking him, where were you, and the prophets, and all of that. And he takes it in. Like, he's not doubting, at least it's not written explicitly that he still doubted. Like, there was an incident where, I think in a previous judge, he got almost three times the signs. He's like, yeah, you've given me this, but okay, another sign and I'll be more assured. Saul did none of that. So I would see that as a positive trait of his character. So chapter 10, 15 and 16. So, and Saul's uncle said, so Saul's uncle asks, hey, what did Samuel say? Please tell me what Samuel said to you. And Saul said to his uncle, he told us plainly that the donkeys had been found. And that's it. But about the matter of the kingdom of which Samuel had spoken, he did not tell him anything. So this is again, like, he is being circumspect. Like, you know, he's not blurting it out. Oh, I'm the king now. And the text doesn't say that he still doubted it. He was more that, okay, what's happening? He was taking it patiently. That's humility, one could argue. Then 22 and 23, same chapter. So they inquired again of the Lord, is there a man still to come? And the Lord said, behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage. Well, that's awkward. Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. Again, emphasizing that he had stature. Like, physically, he was impressive. Internally also, this is like self-doubt. So he wasn't yearning to be a king. He wasn't ambitious. He wasn't this kind of great, I am king now, obey me. But I think this, knowing what we know of Saul, maybe this was a hint of a flaw in his character, that he had too much self-doubt. You contrast that with David. Once David knew that he was anointed, he behaved as an anointed one. You know, that doesn't mean he was proud. That means that he took his role as an anointed one seriously, which Saul did not. Like, he was literally hiding in bags, trying to get away from his anointing. So I think maybe that was a hint of a flaw, but still it is, you know, self-doubt, which I think plays out later in his life. And in verse 27, he is actually crowned, he's anointed by Samuel. But some worthless fellows said, how can this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no present, but he held his peace. So again, another positive attitude that, you know, he didn't have an ego, he didn't immediately react harshly, it was like, you know, how dare you insult, things like that. But he held his peace. But again, hindsight, knowing what we know about him, is it a positive trait, or is it because he wanted to be, like, he's non-confrontational? He didn't want to displease the people. And this attitude of him, the way he did not want to displease people, comes out later. You can study for that yourself, unless I come back to Saul at some point. And then in chapter 11 is Saul's first campaign, actually. So he defeats the king, who I guess, or I gather from most commentaries, like, who was the immediate threat apart from the Philistines from the east. This person, the Nahash, which means snake apparently, from the Ammonites. So he was the immediate threat to the east of Transjordan territories. Nahash, the Ammonite, he attacks Jabesh Gilead. It's in the tribal lands of Manasseh, sort of northeast. and they are under siege. They send for help. Saul, now under God's Spirit, really gets, charged up. And he breaks the yoke of the oxen, and you know the story where he sends it across all the tribes, saying that this will happen to your oxen. I mean, importantly, like initially when I read it, I used to think that this would happen to you if you don't come, but yeah, he wasn't that cruel. This is what will happen to your economy, to your oxen, if you don't come and help your fellow brothers. And he wins a famous battle there, to the point where the Ammonites are no longer a great threat under his reign. And then the people rejoice. So chapter 11, 12 to 15, the kingdom is renewed there. And so basically, I'll just read that. Then the people said to Samuel, Who is it that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has worked salvation in Israel. Then Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal, and there renew the kingdom. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And that's how it ends. So everybody's in a good mood. Saul reacts, again, interestingly, well. He doesn't take revenge on the people who doubted his leadership or his anointing, which was the right thing to do. And chapter 12 forms the crux of my reading, because this is essentially the farewell address of Samuel. Farewell, not that he was dying, but because now that Saul has been anointed king, and therefore the judge, Samuel's reign has ended, like his reign as a judge, or his judgeship has kind of come to a close. He's still a prophet, he still advises down the line, but his role as the judge of the people of Israel has ended at the request of the people of Israel. And this is basically Samuel handing over that title to Saul in an address. So this is his farewell speech. And it's interesting that it is actually mostly a condemnation. So you just imagine Saul, the king that the people wanted, an impressive looking fellow. He's just won against a local conquering king, Nahash the Ammonite. They have saved their own city from mutilation. They're celebrating to the point where some of the people get over enthusiastic in a murderous mood. They're like, you know, who are the ones who were rebellious? Let's kill them, you know, kind of a thing. Saul calms them down. Samuel comes along and says that, okay, you know, yes, let's renew the kingdom. This is your king. I'm handing it over. And then starts his condemnation. So I'll read the whole thing. Chapter 12. And Samuel said to... So perhaps I'll go paragraph by paragraph. And Samuel said to all Israel, behold, I have obeyed your voice in all that you have said to me, and I have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you, and I am old and gray. And behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am, testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hands have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you. They said, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand. And he said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they said, he is witness, he being Saul, and God, of course. So this is kind of a an introductory thing, so, you know, establishing a thing like, you know, I am Samuel, you know me, tell me if there is anything you find lacking in my leadership so far. They say nothing. So then basically, which lays the foundation for taking him seriously. You know, they cannot accuse him of anything, and he is God's anointed prophet, so now take what comes next seriously. So verses 6 onwards, and Samuel said to the people, the Lord is witness, who appointed Moses and Aaron, and brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and for your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them. Okay, this is obviously condensed history. Then your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot the Lord, their God, and he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor. So we heard of this Sisera, the commander, in the book of Judges, during the reign of Deborah and Barak. And into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord and said, we have sinned, because we have forsaken the Lord, and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies, that we may serve you. And the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us. So this verse, I think, established the fact that this was the nearest danger. Nahash, the Ammonite, was the nearest danger that triggered the request or the demand for a king from the people of Israel. No, but a king shall reign over us when Lord your God was your king. So they essentially replaced God with a human king. Verse 13, and now behold the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked. Behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Now therefore stand still and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and you shall know that, and you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking for yourselves a king. So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. So it's interesting that, again, God actually gives them a king. And this is after a major victory. And yet it is a condemnation, because Samuel is confronting people with their sin. The sin of their intention. Why they asked for a king. They asked for a king for themselves. I think, I don't know, I didn't read the original text, but to me it sounded like, you know, you ask something for yourself, of yourself. Instead of asking God what is good for us, they asked God what they wanted, what they thought was good for them, which was a king. And then he goes on and says, now therefore stand still and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. So this is basically, I think, Samuel is entreating God to give a sign of confirmation that this condemnation is real. And it's interesting that it is, it's a damaging condemnation. I don't know if you all know, but during harvest you do not want rain and thunder. That ruins your harvest. And that's why he says, like, look around, it's harvest time, is it not? And especially wheat. So they say yes, and then he sends rain and thunder, which basically killed the harvest. It's a major economic disaster for them. And also, I think, and that's why when they say, and that's why, like, the fear of the Lord came upon them, because, well, okay, number one, Samuel did condemn with words, and then God confirmed with a very negative sign. A sign that is negative to the people. You know, it's a punishment, really. And verse 19 onwards, and all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God, that you may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil, to ask for ourselves a king. And Samuel said to the people, do not be afraid, you have done all this evil. You've done it, but don't be afraid. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. And I think that's the important phrase here. The Lord will not forsake his people, not because we deserve it or because of anything except the simple fact that it is for his own name's sake. His glory and his pleasure that he found in assigning us or the people of Israel as his own people. And that is the only singular reason that he will not forsake us. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. And I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. Which, unfortunately, as we know, does happen many few hundred years later, but it still does happen. Some small points to note. Samuel continues to be a prophet. He continues to be the moral compass for the people of Israel. As he says there, I will, you know, and I will instruct you in the good and in the right way. And Samuel also, the righteous man that he is, he doesn't take it personally, which is, in a way, a rejection of him and his family as the judges. He says that I will not sin against God by ceasing to pray for you. You know, something like what Jonah did when he was given a task. He did not do it because his own pride or his own geopolitical emotions forced him not to do it. But Samuel understood, you know, how one treats when somebody is anointed by God and when something is blessed by God. So even though this was not God's intention, or God still considers this a sin on Israel's part, and yet God did choose Saul. God did establish the kingdom of Saul, as the rest of the chapters will show. So you do not, you know, rebel against that, even if you do not agree with it in that sense. And also the other thing to note here is that in verse 20 it says, and Samuel said to the people, do not be afraid, you have done all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And I think this tells a little fact that, you know, we do choose certain things, and certain choices can be too late to undo. And yet it is never too late to, you know, even in your choices, to follow God, to still ask for his will. You know, sometimes we may have chosen, you know, to move to a different place for a job that, at the cost of, let's say, you know, this is a famous thing, you know, you choose a job because it pays well, but your church life and your spiritual life suffers. You know, it's not always that. It depends on each person's conscience. You need to, you know, inform it yourself. But I don't think it's always a matter of undoing whatever decisions you have taken. Sometimes it can be too late. Sometimes it's all about, okay, this is a decision I've made. Say sorry and ask for God's will. And this is exactly what Samuel says. Yes, you did evil, but serve God. Treat this king as an anointed of God with your intention of serving God, and all will be well. Well, of course, we know memories are short. Our own, certainly the people of Israel had short memories. I think that's something we can relate with. And that ends the chapters that I'll be covering in this lecture. I'm still not over time. So I'm going to summarize my understanding on how to contextualize our life to what we just read. As in, this is not something that on one extreme we can think that, oh, you know, people of Israel, they had such short memories. They were so ungrateful people, this and that. But the more you meditate on this, on the history and the sort of on God's reaction, on Samuel's words of God's condemnation, you would realize that each one of us have done everything that is written over here, which is reject God's leadership in our lives. Either, I'm not saying permanently or things like that, but in moments of our lives, especially when testing times have come. And testing times doesn't necessarily mean conflict. It can also mean prosperity. So they're both as harshly testing of our characters. And so, yeah, just to summarize these five chapters. So it covers many aspects of God's character, human sinfulness, and redemption plan. Like God's redemption plan. So it's so you can see parts of these being very important in, you know, well, in the coming of Jesus. Obviously, the royal lineage was set up, which would fail, and then the actual choice of God, which was David, would come along, and therefore we have down the line Jesus. But then this story, I think, so there are many things to learn about God's character, that he's not some small g God that, you know, you do anything out of his wish and he'll immediately punish you with death and pestilence and things like that. He is an understanding one. He gives you many opportunities to undo your requests or your demands. He gives you a look into your future, what it would be if you continue with what you want rather than what you need from God. And of course, if anything, we have a greater advantage than people of Israel because we have the book. We have the book, we have the history of people to understand how things go wrong when you choose unwisely. And most importantly, at least from my perspective, since I'm interested in history, you know, all this, God's character, his plan, our sinfulness, is not written only in theory or in stories or in, like, in parables, but it's actual history, people who have suffered it, who have gone through it, and who, you know, arguably still suffer through those consequences of having chosen these things. So it's something that's even more relatable in that sense. People have actually done it. There's nothing new under the sun, as it says. So the other application would be that when we make choices, it's very hard. I'll just reiterate what I said in the beginning. It is not between a condemnable sin and a glorifying choice. A lot of our choices in our lives they can be neutral, if I have to use that word. It all depends on how you exercise it, why you make a certain choice. And I think this is a good example of that. It's like the reason behind our choices are infinitely more important than the choices themselves. God, in his power, can make our choices. I mean, our choices are his plan in any case. But the point is, our responsibility is in shepherding our heart, like making our heart tender enough to God's word to make sure that we, whatever we choose, is because we trust in Him, we take Him as our God. We take Him as our leader who fights our battles literally. And not that we want to have a totem, a human totem to somehow identify as our hero and as our salvation. So, and as Christians, like if we have to relate today to the people of Israel back then, I mean, what are the things? Maybe some of these, I have a small list. Some of these, maybe all of these, you may think are relatable. So we as Christians today should relate to the people of Israel because, you know, we live as clusters, loose clusters of people among this world. We don't have a central government of Christianhood, you know, we don't have the Pope as such. So in that sense, it is kind of similar. We are very insignificant people, generally. We typically don't have the world's powerful, the world's strongest, the world's fastest, the world's whatever. There's a lot of skill and talent among Christians. I'm not arguing that, but I'm saying that we, in general, when you look at en masse, we are not very significant people. We do not come across as impressive by height and stature or beauty or whatever. We are typically a speed bump on the road for people who have aspirations and all-conquering aspirations, and we are the speed bump in their, like this moral speed bump that, okay, we are the ones saying that, no, that's not right, or we should be the ones acting as a speed bump. We are the ones tasked with remaining focused on God, as Israel was tasked. You know, forget what's happening around you. Do not mix, do not mingle. Focus on God, follow Him, follow His word. Exactly our task as Christians. And as the people of Israel, we have tasted God's provision and truth. I think that's the major similarity, that we have tasted of all things good that come from God, as Israel did during their entire existence as God's people. And yet we should be able to relate, because we do not remember that every day, every moment. We do not often behave as if we have tasted God's good provision. And therefore we fall into the same sin, the same recurring bad choices that the people of Israel made in our own little way, in our own little lives. And so I have a few points that these are not directly attested by the word that I'm that we just read, but these are things that for you to chew on, like you can land on any side of it, but something to consider. That, you know, when we find ourselves surrounded by persecution, which, you know, one could argue in this day and age, yes, at different levels we do, and contrary principles. It doesn't have to be a persecution, doesn't have to be a person actually persecuting you, but it's just you're surrounded by contrary principles, whether it be homosexuality, it be whatever, like marriages and abomination, other kinds of abominations or sinfulness and things like that. We must, I think, recognize signs of fatigue within ourselves. Fatigue meaning like we are getting tired of hanging on to principles. As when you read the Old Testament, that is the recurring story with the people of Israel. They get tired of holding out, of being the island in that kind of a sea of loose morals or things like that. So it's very important to recognize those signs, either personally or even collectively. And the signs for when we, the justifications, like why, okay, let's encourage that or something. Because when Israel asked for a king, it was a very pragmatic justification for them. Pragmatic justification meaning that it made sense from a worldly perspective. You know, you have all these kings, they are organized, they have central structures. And if you look at most empires, they all have central structures. There's a certain king, he dictates everything, and then there's some loose autonomy given to states. Persians, Babylonians, Romans, they all had central structures. So it was very easy for, and very understandable for the people of Israel to come to the conclusion that, hey, if we have a central structure, a king who will then rule over all the tribes, we will be more secure, we'll be more prosperous. And during these times, actually, they were so far behind the Philistines, even in technology and things like that. So they were sick and tired of that. And that is what, you know, we can be in our lives. We can be sick and tired of being underdogs, you know, where you hold on to principles, you are the one losing the job, or you are the one not getting invited to networking opportunities, or whatever, you know, like in your own life. And then that is when these enticing justifications creep into our thought processes. And on the other side, I would say that when having read this, it is also a very unhealthy practice to then always blame the, within quotes, the barbarians at the gate. You know, this was a famous Roman saying that, you know, the barbarians are at the gate. I always say, how about the ones within the gate? I mean, there are plenty of problems inside. So in all of this, you didn't see God or Samuel, you know, God through Samuel saying that, yeah, the Ammonites, they are really bad. Like, they made you wish for a king. So none, and even like when you read along, the condemnation is very to the point that, okay, you are persecuting my people and that's it. But any decision, any choice that Israel makes out of its own backsliding is never blamed on an outsider. It's always blamed on the people of Israel. So we as Christians are responsible for our own convictions or lack of them, or even holding on to convictions that must not be held on to. And I don't mean doctrinal convictions. I mean like convictions on how to live and how to behave and things like that. So I think these are two extremes. Like, one could be that, you know, all the problems are outside the church. No, I think, as with the people of Israel, almost all of the problems are inside the church. If we do not, if we can't handle outside pressures, it is not because God's grace is lacking. It is because our understanding is lacking. And we need to then, number one, hold ourselves accountable to the God's word, and number two, hold each other accountable. And if you notice that in all the prophets, it is the prophets, you know, God's people, who, well, okay, one judge was not of God's people, but anyway, mostly God's people, who hold God's people accountable. And that is more important to look inward than to blame outwardly. There's plenty that is wrong within our churches, and I'm talking about the collective church, and even within our church, I'm sure it is not, you know, perfect. So the point is, we should be more focused on strengthening our own foundations on how we react to the outside, rather than always getting lost in talking about how we are getting persecuted. Because I'm not saying that is wrong or sinful. I'm just saying that is a slippery slope that potentially, that which is exactly what the people of Israel were on. They saw all the dangers around them, and they were so lost in focusing on the dangers around them, they forgot the dangers within them, within their own hearts. And a minor point, two minor points. So in our own lives, the prophets, I mean, we don't have like God-anointed prophets in our own lives, but we do have people who speak God's word, who will hold us accountable. And just as the people of Israel mostly do. I mean, I know a lot of them were not also, but in these cases, in these instances where they were, we must also hold them at a greater honor. People who have the courage to tell us the truth, either collectively or personally, doesn't matter. I think they should be held in honor. And I'm not saying, you know, worship them or something. It's just that recognize that God is working through them to address you and your sin. And, you know, that's an important office for people who have that conviction to then go around inside our church and address problems that are there. And I'll end with a small thing on Saul. Last 5 minutes. So 1 hour, 15 minutes. Yes. So Saul is still a very interesting personality to me. Like, I suspect, like, we all look at David as, you know, a man after God's own heart. But I think we most often behave like Saul than David. We would like to behave like David, but we end up behaving like Saul. And the thing is, at least when I was reading Saul as a kid or as a youngster or something like that, it always was very dichotomous. It was like, you know, David the good king with God's heart, and Saul the, you know, the useless fellow that, you know, people wanted and they got kicked out. But when you look at it, I mean, Saul came with all kinds of positive traits on the outside. You know, he was, okay, I'm not just talking about physical. He was tall, he was handsome, whatever. But even internally, he was not an aggressive man. He wasn't a violent man. He wasn't, like, he was humble. He did things maybe in a right way. Like, you know, he didn't go on a murderous rampage against people who objected to him. And the thing is, I think it's a very important lesson that a good candidate doesn't mean he is a God's candidate. Good, in a general sense, can be many things. But God's candidate is God's candidate. I mean, and it has implications also, like, you know, I don't know if the people of Israel went along this way, but you can go in life either looking for, I don't know, marriage partners or, you know, a church or anything with a list of things that considered good. You know, this person must be this. You have a whole list of good things, good traits. But the point is, if you forget to entirely trust God, and not just include God, as the people of Israel here did, they included God in their plans. That's not the point. You entirely trust God with your desire. And that's when you get the candidate that God chooses for you. They may not be the ideal candidate, but they are, I mean, from your perspective, but they're still God's candidate. And somebody like Saul, who fulfills all the external positive traits, you can see that in his life, he really falls apart. And I'm not saying that he was always that way. I mean, we can analyze somebody's personality threadbare, you know, you can see that there was a problem in his attitude there. We don't know. We have the benefit of hindsight. That's why we are saying that, yeah, that is a sign of a coming problem. But when you look at his personality only in these first 12 chapters, there is absolutely nothing, hardly anything negative to say about him. And yet, when testing times came, the way he reacted and the way David reacts are diametrically opposite. The way David treats anybody who is an anointed of God versus how Saul treats somebody who he knows is also anointed by God, which is David. So that's just something to perhaps remind ourselves that God is good, but our version of good falls far short of God's version of good. So we need to constantly inform ourselves of what is good only according to God's standard. Yeah. So I wasn't too late this time. So for those of you who weren't here last time, I went on rambling for, I think, 1 hour 40 minutes, was it? So that concludes my lecture for today. I would like to end with a psalm as a prayer. Psalm 141. O Lord, I call upon you. Hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. Let my prayer be counted as incense before you, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, to busy myself with wicked deeds, in company with men who work iniquity, and let me not eat of their delicacies. Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil for my head. Let my head not refuse it. Yet my prayer is continually against their evil deeds. When their judges are thrown over the cliff, then they shall hear my words, for they are pleasant. As when one ploughs and breaks up the earth, so shall our bones be scattered at the mouth of Sheol. But my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. Keep me from the trap that they have laid for me, and from the snares of evildoers. Let the wicked fall into their own nets while I pass by safely. Amen.